probably going to be readily apparent to you. It is not an attempt to put on paper everything that we've said. That would be about 400 pages, more than you want to carry around, more than I want to try to write. But this is rather a condensed, abridged, truncated, abbreviated version of what we've covered, but it does follow the basic structure. And my hope is that, of course, many of you have been very conscientious taking notes along the way in class, and my hope is that using this outline, plus any notes you may have, plus your own recollection of what we've covered, you can kind of pull it together in one place here. You might want to even annotate what we've got here, so that in time to come, you'll be able to refer back to it and hopefully remember some of what we've treated. Since this is our last Sunday, I want to take just a minute and indulge in the luxury of a brief review.
Sweetheart.
And not that we really have time to do it, but I want to anyway, because I want you to all see how I caught all the spelling errors and everything here, which I hope I did. But anyway, you'll notice that there's two blocks. There's Roman numeral 1, starting on page 1, the being of God, which centered basically on the idea of His holiness. Now on the second page, you'll see Roman numeral 2, the doing of God. And you'll recall all along we've made that basic distinction. Concerning the being of God, Roman numeral 1, then we made a further distinction between His incommunicable and His communicable attributes. And we've broken down then some of the material we covered there. And I won't go line by line through this. But then on the second page, the section we're treating right now is God's doing. And we have, as you recall, three chapters that treat this. The first of them on the decrees of God, and that's capital A of God's eternal decree. That's chapter 3. Then the next thing is God creates. So on the last page you'll see that capital B is of creation. Now I'm giving that very short treatment because we didn't actually cover it. Next week we'll come to that chapter. We're going to go in reverse next week and look at chapter 4, because most of that really treats the creation of humanity. And so that'll be a good introduction then to our next segment in the Westminster, which covers the whole biblical doctrine of humanity. But for the sake of the orderliness of it, it's inserted right here. And finally, we have the question of providence. And that's capital C then on the third page of providence. The basic definition of providence is given to us in paragraph 1 of chapter 5, which basically asserts that God upholds, directs, disposes, and governs all creation. Now again, let's just keep in mind the logic. God decrees before any of it. He then creates, and it's in that which He has created that He then works out through His providence what He decreed to do. So the logic of it all fits together in that respect. It's not really chronological because this is outside of time, but it is at least a logical sequence. He decrees, followed by creation, followed by providential sovereign oversight. His providence, again to the outline, is applied in three different areas. The first of these is in the area of causation, which we looked at very briefly last week. That's paragraphs 2 and 3. And then in the area of evil, which is what we look at today, 4 through 6. And finally in the area of the church, which is paragraph 7. So if you follow, you'll see that's basically the way we have it organized here and now. So that's all we'll do, looking at the outline, but hang on to that and if you have your Westminster, we'll be shifting then to the material. It starts in paragraph 6.027. So that's the material we start with today. I'm feeling, frankly, a substantial amount of continued I don't want to say frustration, but I guess the feeling of all the things that we haven't had a chance to say, especially on this subject. And I hope you can appreciate this is just, again, kind of touching on these points lightly, and that's especially true today, where we're going to cover really a substantial amount of material, plus finish up Romans, and all, you know, then get ready for our treatment of a new subject beginning next week. It would be lots of fun to go back over this once again and just kind of take things we didn't get a chance to talk about. But I'm hopeful that in prioritizing what should be said, what shouldn't be said, we've chosen the things that were the most important to say, and I know that you're all bright and insightful and intelligent, and you'll be able to put together the remainder of it, even though we couldn't address it specifically in the time that we had in class. Okay, we're going to start with paragraph 4 then of chapter 5, but let's have a word of prayer first, and then we'll get underway. Father, we're deeply grateful. We're deeply grateful again to you for the opportunity which is ours to examine the Westminster Confession, to get this taste of the heritage that's ours in the history of your dealings with your people, church, throughout the history of the church, to see the insight that was given to these who were engaged in the development and formulation of this confessional statement, to continue to muse and to reflect in our own minds on how we come to terms with those things that are set forth here. We pray that you would engage our minds and our hearts, that as a result of having been here, we would be possessed of deeper insight into your word. We would have a readier heart and mind to serve and worship and love you. It's to that end that we commit our time together in Jesus' name. Amen. These three paragraphs probably get as close, and especially paragraph 4, probably get as close as any place in the Westminster of attempting to explain this relationship between God's providence or God's sovereignty on the one hand and evil on the other. And, you know, understand we are approaching one of the most difficult questions. And the Westminster doesn't purport to be, you know, a great theological treatise. It's a terse statement setting out, you might say, the parameters, locating the area within which that mystery has to be confined. It is not this, it is not that, it is somewhere in here. And that's essentially all we can do as well, is to try to say, this is where the Westminster locates the mystery. A mystery abides. We cannot finally resolve it. We can try to reduce the area so that we're not falling into error on one side or the other, but finally there's something there which defies explanation. And I think the Westminster attempts to narrow it in as well as can be done within the confines of a statement such as this one, basically in paragraph 4. So that's where we'll spend the bulk of our time in the Westminster this morning. Reads this way: the almighty power, unsearchable wisdom, and infinite goodness of God so far manifest themselves in his providence that it extendeth itself even to the first fall and all other sins of angels and men, and that not by a bare permission, but such as hath joined with it a most wise and powerful bounding, and otherwise ordering and governing of them in a manifold dispensation to his own holy ends. Yet, so as the sinfulness thereof proceedeth only from the creature, not from God, who being most holy and righteous, neither is nor can be the author or approver of sin. Shed some light on that for you. Okay, now let's see if we can discern the meaning here. This is the problem. We have God being sovereign, and we have evil. And we have providence, which you might say is the means, that's probably not the right word, but somehow the way in which God in His sovereignty reaches down into this world and effects His purposes which He decreed. Providence is His arm reaching into creation and accomplishing that which He set out to do. He's sovereign up here. The problem, of course, is that if part of what He's wanting to accomplish involves evil, then are we not forced to the conclusion that God Himself is somehow perpetrating it? That's the problem, isn't it? If this were a perfect world where there were no evil, then no problem, you see. Or if we predicated that God was only limited in it, He's only George Burns. I mean, He can only do so much, you know. You like the movie. All He can do is come and try to give us a little prod now and then, but He is not sovereign, then there'd be no problem. But the problem is when we try to assert both sides of this proposition and hold them in an equivalent, you know, posture of accent. That's where the problem arises. All right, well, the resolution of it, or at least the limitation of the problem. We have God's power, His wisdom, His goodness. Now here, you see, here's the first side of the proposition. The Westminster never backs down, never equivocates, never apologizes at this point. For this, we have to at least be grateful for the clarity with which this is proposed. The power, the wisdom, the goodness of God so far manifest themselves in His providence that it extends even to the fall. We're not saying that the providence of God, you see, kind of goes halfway. It kind of comes this far, then it's cut off, and the fall happens somewhere else. No, the providence of God actually extends to the fall. It was not an accident. It was not a surprise. God didn't go, oh my goodness, what has happened? You know, a catastrophe in my plan. Plan B now is going to have to come in. No, no, no. From the very beginning, God decreed what would happen, and that part of what He decreed and providentially worked out was that there would be a fall. A responsible fall, not a coerced fall, because that would not be evil. If God simply yanked a string on a puppet and it didn't act, that wouldn't be evil. So it's more sophisticated than that. It's God sovereignly ordained that there would be a responsible, moral rebellion against Him. There would be a fall. Not just the fall, though. It goes on. It extends itself even to the first fall, and, continuing, all other sins of angels and men. It doesn't just stop with the fall, but it reaches out and touches all sins. The providence of God. Okay, that's the difficulty, and I would be irresponsible to try to represent to you anything less than what it's saying. That's what it's saying. Although I feel once again with you the dilemma of it. So, well, how about we handle it this way? We say to Westminster, well, okay, I see the providence of God reaches to these things, but this is kind of His quote permissive will. We have the very highest and best over here, and then we have this kind of permissive side of it, you see. Does that get us out of it? And the Westminster says, nope, sorry, won't let you do that. And that, not by a bare permission. Not just God being permissive. See, just crowded into a corner. I mean, every time we try to wiggle out from under this, the Westminster says, no, this is what is being said. So then we ask, and of course the question it comes down to then, well, is then how is that connection made? How do we have the providence of God touching human activity, even at the point of sinful human activity, such that that sinful human activity is still an expression of that which He has ordained to accomplish, and yet He is not thereby rendered the perpetrator of the evil? That's the question. And now here's where we find this language, which is, I'm sure that they spent a substantial amount of time working on this, and it helps. It does help. But it's not the kind of thing you just sort of read like the newspaper.
So here we are. And all other sins of angels and men, and that not by their permission, but, and here's the explanation, here's the essence of this paragraph, but such as have joined with it, that is, this evil, has joined with it a most wise and powerful bounding, as in setting boundaries, okay, setting bounds, and otherwise ordering and governing of them. So we have God bounding these things. He's ordering them. He's governing them in a manifold dispensation. That word is suggests administration or oversight to his own holy end. So we have four words here. Bounding, ordering, governing, and dispensation. And then, okay, let's take that much then just to see what it kind of suggests to our minds. So the idea here is that somehow, if we can picture this, God is coming in and restricting activities. The idea, he's bounding, he's setting boundaries, he's ordering this activity, this sinful activity. The sinful activity occurs, but it occurs within the boundaries that God sets. He governs it, he orders it, it is his administration of it. Okay. Then taking the rest of it to his own holy ends, yet so as the sinfulness thereof, that is the sinfulness of the activity, okay, proceeds only from the creature and not from God, who being most holy and righteous neither is nor can be the author or approver of sin. Now you see there's a distinction that's being made, and this is what we have to play with for a minute to come to terms with the way this has worked out. There's a distinction that's being made between, you might say, the activity itself and its sinfulness. Now we make that distinction ourselves, so this is not a strange thing. If you were in the first service, or if you're going to be in the second service, you will hear Dick give a brilliant sermon, in my estimation, on the whole question of the will of God. And I want to just close in on one particular component that he talks about there, which is he talks about one way of ascertaining the will of God. I like the image that he uses, that it's not a tight wire the way most people strangle themselves conceiving of it, you see. Some strange thing to be determined, and if I miss it, I'm lost forever kind of thing. Well, that's not the way it's set forth in Scripture. Certainly not the way it's set forth in the Westminster, but one some of the guideposts that he uses, one question is it right? And in that connection, he talks about the Ten Commandments. The use of the Ten Commandments my thought has taken flight. Did you see it go out the window there already? I think it's gone. It'll come back to me. Oh, I was relishing in how good a sermon that was. Oh, well, forgive me. All right, I will be groping here for a second, but yeah, no, wasn't that? Okay, well, let's come back. I don't want to lose this completely in confusion here. It'll come back to me in a second, I think. Anyway, the attack that's being taken here in paragraph 4, the idea that here it is, it's coming back, the distinctions. We distinguish, I knew it. In the Ten Commandments, we have various activities that are prohibited, right? And we know that sometimes a given activity can be okay, and on other occasions, the same activity can be wrong. We make that distinction, don't we? The same activity. I mean, probably the most the illustration that comes most quickly to mind, for example, might be the sexual relationship, which we know confined to its proper setting in marriage is a beautiful and wonderful thing. But we also know, at least from the biblical perspective, that if it's taken away from its marital context, then it becomes something that's wrong. It's the same act, it's the same activity. In one setting, it's good.
healthy, wonderful, lovely, and in another setting, the same activity is sinful. We make that distinction. We can really make that distinction in many cases concerning virtually every sin, that it's an action which in itself, the action in itself could be called neutral. And there is something else that sort of overarches it, determining whether it is good or evil. And that overarching consideration ultimately traces back to what is the disposition of the heart which is carrying on this activity toward God. An action can, on one hand, I'm talking about the same action, can on one occasion be an act of obedience to God. The same action can, on another occasion, be a sinful expression of rebellion toward God. And it's the same action. See, that distinction we're capable of making, we can abstract from the activity its moral composition and treat that separately. Now that's not something that people have always done. There's been a temptation occasionally, I think, in the history of the church to identify certain actions with their moral content much too closely. Jesus makes an interesting statement in the book of Mark when he says, it's not what goes into the mouth that defiles, it's what comes out of the mouth, you see. And he was critiquing the Pharisaical mistake of doing that. That there is something inherently evil, let's say, about eating this food. And what Jesus wanted to say at that point was, no, that the inherent evil is not in the act. It is rather in something much more basic to our disposition toward that. If I eat it thinking or believing or knowing it to be wrong, then that makes it wrong. But it's not wrong because it is wrong intrinsically. It's wrong because of what my heart has brought to it as a moral disposition. If I'm shaking my fist in the face of God and trying to find some way of expressing that sinfulness, and I find XYZ activity, even if it's neutral, if I do it to express my hostility toward God, then it becomes evil by virtue of my heart's disposition. Does that make sense so far? Are you kind of with me on that? Okay. Now, this is what the Westminster, I think, is saying here when it talks about abounding. Let's say that we have a person with a heart bent on sin, which, by the way, we are all born with. So let's just say we have one of us. And we have a heart bent on treason against God. And what I'm reflecting on now is, how am I going to express my rebellion against God? Am I going to do it by activity A, activity B, activity C, or activity D? Which am I going to do? Any one of them would be a potential way of saying to God, I reject your authority in my life. I still have to make a decision here. Well, I think what the Westminster is getting at in this, by talking about bounding, is here you have sinful people, and what they finally choose to do, let's say, is activity B. That activity B, while it was a free expression of their own moral hostility toward God, was yet something that He bounded them. In other words, that they did B as opposed to C was still within the mind of God from the foundation of the world. But the sinfulness of it stemmed from their own heart. The fact that activity B became sinful is not that God committed a sin, but simply that God restricted the expression of that sin to that particular form. You see what I'm saying?
Pardon? Would that be a predestined?
Well, it would, yeah. And that's a good way of putting it. The word predestined is probably restricted to those cases where God is predestining people to life, so you're in the right context. But probably the word that would be generally used would be His ordination. He's ordained it. You see how that works? That's why we can have this. He does it by a most wise and powerful bounding, ordering, governing. But the sinfulness of it comes from the creature. Now, I'm not saying that finally resolves it. I'm saying that's how the Westminster attempts to get as close as possible to what is a real lively mystery of how this can work.
I want to raise a question at this point. I'm prepared to move on for the sake of time, but I don't want to just hasten on. We're not leaving the subject. We're going to go to Romans for a minute, and it was not a way of dodging, but it is a way of illustrating the thing we're talking about, because it's interesting. The last major theme that Paul takes up in Romans, remember last week, if you were with us, we made it down to Romans chapter 11. We worked through this idea of election and the objections that are raised to it. The final objection, the objections you recall, are that it's not fair. We saw Paul's disposition of that in Romans 9. That it reduces us to puppets. It's a fatalism. We saw that again in Romans 9. The objection that it thwarts and stifles any interest in evangelism, which is really what we looked at last week, that Paul's answer to that is, you know, don't hide behind election when it comes to evangelism. The evangelistic message is, look, all you got to do is open your mouth and believe in your heart. You can go that, you can say that to anybody. You don't have to go up and do a litmus test. Now, let's see, are you elect or not? Why bother preaching the gospel to you? None of this, you see. Paul says, you preach the gospel to everybody. And in fact, he says it to each of us, lest we concern ourselves. I wonder if I'm elect. You know, why am I elect? I don't feel very elect today. Paul says, don't worry about it. You confess with your mouth Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart. You do it. You do it. You do it right here. Don't sweat what the sovereign plan of God is. At that point, you just do it and you will be saved. And I can in good faith say that to anybody. Now, I may find out at the end that those who finally did open their mouths and believe in their hearts were those that God had chosen from the foundations of the world. But I don't go out and say to this guy, look, if you're chosen from the foundation of the world, you're lucky enough that your number came up then if you're a believer, etc. I don't have to do that. I can say, all I have to do is preach that message, preach that gospel. Yes?
I remember, you may not, but I remember Mrs. Chabot just loved to illustrate this story. She said, if we get into heaven and on the promise, whosoever will, yeah, so the Lord may come. And when we walk through the gates, we turn and look back and we say, we see chosen.
I think that's a pretty famous illustration of that idea, and I think it does help. There is an open invitation. Anybody. Then what we find out on the other side is those that did indeed respond. That was the third objection. Then we come now rapidly to the fourth of them, which gets to this issue that we've just been talking about, God's providence and all of that. And it's an interesting illustration of it, and it also kind of brings it on the side, the fourth objection, that doesn't it create in our hearts a sense of arrogance to think that I am elect? If I really think I'm elect, then doesn't that make me feel like I'm pretty hot stuff, you know, and I can develop kind of conceit? And so, here's what Paul says. He's just talked about how in the case of Israel, you know, for any salvation, it takes two things. It takes gospel, it takes grace. He raises the question, well, did Israel have gospel? Did they have gospel? He says, they heard it. They understood it. They were inundated. I mean, if anyone ever had gospel, it was Israel. They were flooded. They were absolutely overwhelmed with gospel. Jesus himself was there among them. You see, what kind of gospel do you need? And so the reason that they rejected was not a lack of gospel. And then he raises the question then in chapter, I mean, it's the only thing, if it takes gospel and grace, and the problem was not a lack of gospel, then what are we left with? It's been a lack of grace. And he raises the question, well, does that mean God rejected his people? Chapter 11, verse 1. And Paul's answer, you see, is, well, he didn't reject his people, but his non-rejection of them was predicated on this remnant. So we have in verse 5, so too at the present time there is a remnant who were so good and so virtuous that God couldn't resist them. Oh, no, that's not true. So too, at the present time, there is a remnant chosen by grace. And if by grace, it is not by works. Otherwise, grace would not be grace. What about the rest? That's the big question. We have the minority, the remnant, the fraction. What about the rest? Well, concerning the rest, Paul says, Verse 7, what then? What Israel sought, you see, overall so earnestly, it didn't obtain. The elect obtained it. The rest were hardened. God gave them a spirit of stupor, eyes so they could not see, ears so that they could not hear. David says, may their table be a snare and a trap, a stumbling block, etc. Their eyes be darkened, and so on. Which brings then the next question, the logical question to raise in verse 11, is this, you know, why did God do this? What was the overarching plan here? And it brings in this providence issue. Look at what he says, verse 11. I ask then, did they stumble so as to fall beyond recovery? Now we know that there's a massive stumbling of ethnic Israel. They basically, in toto, rejected Christ. Only a tiny, tiny fraction of ethnic, you see, Jewish people in the first century, or since then, have ever recognized and embraced the Messiah. So Paul's question is, was this a final, absolute passing over of them, ethnic Israel? He says, not at all. You get what he says? Rather, because of their transgression, salvation has come to the Gentiles to make Israel envious. Humanly speaking now, leaving the sovereignty of God and all of that out of it, humanly speaking, if you know your New Testament, what was the reason that the gospel got exported from Israel to the rest of the world? Humanly, what happened? They were kicked out. That's right. There was such hostility, there was such persecution, there was such resentment against the Christian church, against the Messiah, against all of this, that they were driven out. Now, do you suppose if Israel, ethnic Israel, now had embraced the Messiah with one accord, had recognized this is the one, had accepted him as their own, how motivated do you suppose the early church would have been to spread the gospel around the world? Just look at us. I mean, how motivated are we? I know there's a few. There's the Scott Burbanks and so on. You get the Macedonian column. And I have to admit, I'm kind of lazy when it comes to the idea of going to the reaches of the world and preaching the gospel. I mean, all of us, there's a kind of an inert mass within us, isn't there? That really is kind of resistant to going to... And it takes a lot of pressure on God's part to get us rolling, doesn't it? But do you know, God was so concerned about making sure the gospel pronto got out of Palestine into the world that the idea here is suggested, Paul says, that it was by their very transgression that God's plan was worked out. It was by the transgression of Israel. By this evil, the persecution, the stoning of Stephen, the martyrdom that took place, the persecution, which is nothing but evil itself, being brought to bear against the church, which ultimately came about as the greatest good. Really, you know, at least certainly I think from the posture of a Christian historian, one of the greatest goods that could ever have happened in Western history was that the church infiltrated the world with the gospel. And yet, you see, it started with something that was singularly evil, persecution of the church. Paul says, rather, because of their transgression, salvation has come to the Gentiles. And then he adds, to make Israel envious. And I'll come back to that in a minute. If their transgression means riches for the world, their loss means riches for the Gentiles, how much greater will their fullness be? This idea of making Israel envious is very interesting, and Paul expands on that in the next verses. I am talking to you Gentiles, Paul says. Now, inasmuch as I am the apostle to the Gentiles, I'm making a big deal out of my ministry. But Paul says, let me tell you what my hidden agenda is here, my hidden motivation. I'm making a big deal about my ministry to the Gentiles in the hope that I may somehow arouse my own people to envy and save some of them. Because if their rejection is the reconciliation of the world, what will their acceptance of the Messiah be but, as it were, life from the dead? Think about what happened in ethnic Israel as they saw the church exported to the world.
all of a sudden you've got all of these Gentiles all over the world. And what are they doing? They're reading the Old Testament. And, you know, the way this kind of hits me is sometimes I have to come to my door, you know, so let's say a Mormon. And they come walking up to my door. They're carrying a Bible. A Bible. I said, what are you doing with that Bible? I'm the Christian here. Who do you think you are carrying a Bible? That's my Bible, I want to say. You see, there's kind of an envy, a kind of a jealousy when I see someone in a cult or someone in some offbeat, you know, strange brand of theology carrying a Bible around. What are they? Who do they think they are? That's my Bible. I'm a Christian, you know, and I want to take it from them and say, you can have your cult, but don't try to take my Bible and use it as your weapon. And don't you see, that's how Israel felt about it. Here were all of a sudden these Gentiles all over the world reading their Old Testament, claiming David to be a great hero of the Christian tradition. You know, the Christian tradition. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob became great Christian heroes. How jealous do you think Israel must have become to see the whole world basking in the wonder of the Old Testament, which had been the personal, private possession of ethnic Israel through all those centuries? You see how envious that would have made them.